About 25 centuries ago, a young Indian prince renounced the world and renounced his own throne in order to become a philosopher. The cause behind his action was obvious. India was in trouble. There was feuding and fighting and war, jealousy between rulers, and the Hindu religion into which he was born was suffering from a series of desperate perversions. The more sincere followers of the faith were neglected, ignored, and persecuted, and worldly ambitions ran very high. In this emergency, Prince Siddhartha became convinced that there must be a straight and proper way to live. And because of the conditions we are in today, his ideas and his philosophies seem to have very special continuing interests and value to us. Some ways, in looking over his teachings, it would seem that he was a contemporary with us. He had the same problems, and he approached them in the most thoughtful way, a way that perhaps will intrigue or influence a great deal of modern thinking, if it is given the chance to do so. Studying the condition of man, Prince Siddhartha began to develop a series of internal solutions to problems based upon one simple concept, namely, his definition or discussion of the nature of deity. He said, if God does not prevent evil, he is not good. And if God cannot prevent evil, he is not God. Something had to explain the condition of the world without blaming it on mysterious factors and forces abiding in space. Buddha, as he became more generally known, had the concept that it was necessary for the human being to reorganize his concepts concerning life, that he must sometime face the problem of his own destiny himself, instead of leaving it to others on future ages or depending upon past times. Each person must work out his own salvation with diligence. Because of this attitude, many people of Asia and also many missionaries from the West assumed that Buddha was an atheist because he did not follow the traditional form of casting the burdens upon the Lord. He felt that it was about time for the human being to face himself. He was probably dramatically correct, but it took a long time for the world to realize what he meant. And there is still only a few who sense the magnitude of the conviction that he gave the world. To begin with, then, Buddha advanced what he called the four great truths. And these four truths, or four realities, or four facts, are the problem of the cause of suffering, the nature of suffering, the end of suffering, and the way to find the end of suffering. To Buddha, the great burden of the world was pain, not necessarily just physical pain, but spiritual pain, moral pain, mental pain, emotional pain, suffering. The burden of all that is born, the yoke that all must wear, and this strange, mysterious negation which intrudes itself in every moment of human life. In the moment of great joy, pain is near. In the moment of success, failure is near. Why must man face suffering of some kind through the entire period of his life? I think Buddha would have answered that in this way, that the human being has never been educated to prevent suffering. He has been given all kinds of ways to try to get over it, if possible, usually ineffectively. He has never recognized the fact that suffering is a symbol. It is not a symbol of the fact that deity dislikes him. It is not a symbol of the tyrannies of nature. To Buddha, suffering was the symbol of the ignorance of man himself, that he is the cause of his own suffering, collectively and individually. And it is necessary for him to correct this cause if he is to liberate the world from pain and misery. The great sufferings are war, pestilence, natural disasters. The smaller sufferings are physical pains, emotional stress, broken homes, wayward children, poverty, disease. All these are forms of suffering, and they all arise within man himself. If the human being had devoted as much time to the solution of his own internal problems as he has devoted to the extension of his material environment, he would be in far better condition than he is today. We explore space. The Brahmins were exploring it long ago. We send spaceships out. We go into laboratories with all kinds of chemical devices. We create computers and engines and machines. But suffering goes on because the individual has not been taught the mystery of his own nature. He has not been given the courage to correct the mistakes in his own conduct. Of course, while Buddha lived a long time ago, there was a long time before he came. And from the past, he gained certain instruction and inspiration, even as we do today if we are thoughtful. He realized that conditions have gone on the simple basis that whatever happens has to happen. There may be no reason for it. A tyrant arises, it's too bad. But there has always been tyranny. Wars come, it is regrettable. But there have always been wars. Man has always been fighting to win a war, not to prevent one. If he had put as much energy, money, and time into securing the peace, he would have been in a much better condition. Buddha pointed that out when he talked to the Indian general, East Indian generals, 2,500 years ago. Also, Buddha pointed out that all these wars and confusions and conflicts and disagreements and political misunderstandings have had very little effect upon the boundaries of nations. In modern times, World War II cost over 50 million lives. And yet today, the boundaries are much the same. No great achievement was made. No great problem was solved. All this, and then a little quiet, and another war. What are we doing? Why are we continuously destroying our own peace of mind? And Buddha, looking it over very thoughtfully and carefully, came to a philosophical conclusion. We must realize that in its original form, Buddhism was not a religion. Buddhism was an ethical and moral philosophy, a way of life. And this way of life included a concept of veneration for the divine plan of things. But Buddha was not primarily a religionist. He was primarily an ethical reformer with a very profound insight into the nature of the human being, possibly one of the deepest insights the world has ever known. So he began his study of the problem by attempting to define the nature of suffering. What is it? He said that there are numerous causes of suffering, but all of these causes are subject to remedy. They are subject to correction before the suffering sets in. There are many, many ways in which we attempt to solve problems, but until we reach a realization of the basic facts of things, we will not solve the problem. The basic facts lie inside of each one of us. These basic facts are very powerful in the lives of some and may cause them to be very dangerous people. In others, these facts of life are simply partly present, and these persons are less dangerous and more reformable. But in every instance, the cause lies inside of the person. And from there it spreads outward, contaminating other persons. And when a whole group of contaminated individuals form the population of a nation, the nation is contaminated. Its projects are undermined. And those who are of nobler person and mind are disposed of because they interfere with the private ambition of those who have badly organized internal motive patterns. So to begin with, suffering begins when the individual allows attitudes and appetites to interfere with common sense. Common sense, the most uncommon of the senses, has to do with the person's reaction to circumstances. There are very few persons whose actions do not result in consequences which these persons do see, do face, do know about, but do not correct. Therefore, in the beginning of suffering is an unreasonable, impractical, unenlightened relationship with the world around us and with the life within us. It has been there always. Some say it is due to ignorance. Now, there are two kinds of ignorance: simple ignorance and complex ignorance. Simple ignorance is the ignorance of the savage and the child. Complex ignorance is far more difficult to work with. It is ignorance which arises not from necessity, but from the unwillingness to face the restrictions of self. It is a kind of educated ignorance which results from being taught the wrong things and having education deprived of every factor that could result in a mature, educated person. Now, we must remember that 2,000 years ago in India, we did not have the situation that we have there now. The great University of Nalanda was one of the highest educational structures on earth, with a student body of over 25,000 and over 1,000 professors. And in the University of Nalanda, Christianity was taught as comparative religion. Things happened. The ancient world of classical Asia was destroyed. Wars and pestilences, most of them due to the abuse of natural resources, came in, decimated and depleted the people. But it was not necessary that this should happen. It was necessary to face up to these problems, rather than to allow them to accumulate forever. Now, we all know, and Buddha knew, that reforming other people is probably the world's most unrewarding effort. Also, a very dangerous one. But to start by improving our own natures is very important, because one of the principles of Indian philosophy, both Hindu and Buddhist, is that the individual, being a transient being, having only a few years in this world, should be more concerned with following and obeying nature than he is adjusting to human society. It is good to be adjusted, but the individual who compromises his principles in order to achieve a measure of success here is making a mistake, because he is not going to be here long enough for his measure of success to be meaningful, and he is going to depart from here with a bad burden of unfinished business. Actually, therefore, the problem sums up in a very simple way. How is the person going to understand first the nature of suffering? Buddha tells us that suffering is a very definite part of all existence, that it is caused by selfishness and ignorance. Now, selfishness is injuring yourself or others for gain. Ignorance is being instructed wrongly or not receiving the educational advantages that have descended to us from the past. Now, the educational advantages of the past are not necessarily carefully recorded in our educational institutions. When it comes to knowing the wisdom of the past, history is better than education, because history shows us our mistakes, and education tries to prove to us that that which was a mistake was not a mistake. That the real success is to keep on making the same mistakes, but making them with greater scientific assistance. Just one more step of scientific assistance, and we may not be here to make mistakes. We have not learned. So Buddha says the beginning of suffering is ignorance and selfishness. Ignorance being improperly educated, not being taught what is true, being prepared to build a career around selfishness. So that the combination of education inspiring selfishness results in suffering. Suffering is wherever we use natural resources unwisely or without consideration for the common good. Selfishness causes us to try to monopolize resources. Such monopoly may make a few dollars in profit, but ends in suffering. The individual who tries to exploit his neighbor gains a little profit, but in the end contributes to suffering. Every action which is contrary to integrity causes suffering on the person who commits it and on others. Now, Buddha pointed out, however, one redeeming point in this, that while our mistakes bring suffering to ourselves, it does not necessarily follow that others will be injured. The only reason why others are injured is because they more or less agree with our mistakes. They think that success, as we have it, is desirable for them also, and that they, in turn, are likely, through self-interest, to buy the mistakes that we sell them. And as a result, suffering comes to them. Actually, each individual has a right to refrain from the causes of suffering within himself. And temptation is a form of having someone else try to convince you that you should do certain things for motives of self-interest. Where this happens, trouble comes. So the broad point of suffering is that it is the result of breaking the simple rules of life. And these rules cannot be broken without suffering. The idea that we can reconstruct the universe closer to our heart's desire, this idea is false. We have no power to control or master that which extends through the vast reaches of infinity. The space that goes on forever cannot be dominated by the human mind. What we call conquering it simply means to stick a probe in it and try to see what's there. We cannot conquer it. We cannot master it. And it's a case of trying to break rules and suffering, or deciding to keep rules and removing, step by step, the causes of suffering. If then we are concerned with this matter, Buddha gives us a series of examples, all of which indicate, before we get through with it, that the source of suffering within ourselves is emotional or mental or both. The mind is the cause of most suffering. It is assumed to be an infallible instrument, and it is not. The mind can make any mistake that we want it to make. It is a hired servant of our own whims. It obeys whatever will we bestow upon it. And it tries to help us to fulfill the schemes which have already dominated our consciousness. The emotions also constitute a tremendous pressure, a pressure for gratification of appetites of all kinds. And in gratification of these appetites, we compromise integrity. Everywhere we go, no one or very few people have become wise enough to know that they cannot be dishonest without pain, and that gradually the pain becomes unbearable. And yet they go to the grave with the pain and the dishonesty both intact. This is because we haven't been willing to accept, on a scientific level, that which was obvious to the ancients for thousands of years and is being repeatedly demonstrated to us every day of our contemporary lives. And yet there is only one consideration, and that is profit. As long as a person is willing to sell his own soul for a dollar, he is going to know pain, and plenty of it, because he cannot compromise the integrities within himself without physical suffering, or the integrities of his thoughts and emotions without mental and emotional suffering. Buddha was very clear on these points, and I don't think anyone has ever been able to refute him, because the obvious consequences of action are too definite. A second stamp is, of course, we know that suffering exists. Now we can begin to analyze how it operates. Therefore, we say, what is suffering, and what is the cause of suffering? For example, a man devotes his life to accumulating wealth, and he succeeds. And having accumulated wealth, he feels that he has fulfilled his own destiny. But this man is already in trouble. By the time he has accumulated the wealth, the suffering has already started, and there's no way of avoiding it. In the first place, as Buddha said, the man who has is forever living in the fear of loss. Someone is going to take away from him that which he has, and by taking it away from him will result in great anguish of nature for him, for the reason that he has put his happiness in his pocketbook.
who steals that makes him a beggar indeed. Now, the other man, faced with the problem of money, doesn't succeed in accumulating the fortune. So he is miserable because he has not the money. The man who has it is afraid of losing it. The man who has not got it is miserable because he can't get it. And nothing is happy anywhere in the picture. It just keeps right on going. Now, the ambition to have is not only leading us to the problem of a society which wishes to rob us of what we have on the slightest provocation, and respect and puts us in the spot of inflation and all the problems of finances that we have today with unstable dollars, the world economy upside down, the unemployment rising. All of this is part of the byproduct of a false ambition in the first place. We have done it wrong from the beginning. We have made error glamorous. We have made certain procedures satisfying to the selfishness in ourselves. And when the castle we have built falls down, we are all miserable, and we look around trying to figure out who caused it, and finally lay the blame upon the devil. Which he has been blamed for so many things, however, that I guess he can stand the burden better than we can. But how does it happen that for 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000 years, back into the time of Egypt, we have followed such a pattern, fully aware that it won't work, fully aware that the price of what we have is too great for what we get out of it, and nobody changes? Still that hope, that gamble, that belief that we in ourselves will be happy with that which has made all others miserable, or that we alone are miserable because we have not got what all others are seeking. So here is a problem of suffering. And in the gaining of this today, we find that the complication of accumulation is itself a great cause of suffering in many ways. We are having more and more coronaries in middle life for successful business people. The constant struggle to accumulate, the constant effort to outwit the competitor, these are working a terrible hazard upon our healths, upon our dispositions, and upon all the personal values of living. They are impoverishing our lives, damaging our homes, and wrecking our bodies. And yet it's all in the great cause. We want to be, if possible, the richest man in the family graveyard. This is our great joy. Now, Buddha also points out that if we worked like this for a whole lifetime getting it, and we finally do get it, and it's cost us everything else beside that which we determined to get, then in the midst of all this, we wrap the curtains of our couch about us and lie down and die. We don't even live long enough to enjoy a part of what we have done. We have sacrificed life and never lived to make the sacrifice worthwhile. If we were going to live 500 years with the wealth, it might seem more useful or more reasonable to do things. But in the midst of accumulation, we drop down and out. And all that we have worked for with a lifetime, from the beginning of our schooling to the day of our death, is left behind. Why, then, should we make this world miserable and ourselves miserable to get something that we cannot live long enough to use? And if we do not use it, we leave it to others who haven't earned it, who either lose it or abuse it. And their story I've told of the old Roman who, after he was dead, used to sit as a ghost in his house and watch his children squander his funds. It would be a very unhappy experience, but it is the only experience no matter what we leave behind, someone will ultimately abuse it, even if we leave it to an institution. The institution will change in the course of time. There is no solution. So we are following a will-o'-the-wisp, and in the sense of accumulation, we have gradually built up a world of competition leading to war, crime, and all kinds of misdemeanors, and we have to sit in the midst of this. The thief has to be afraid that he will be robbed in turn. There is no safety in anything. Yet the world keeps right on going. Our great codes do not correct the situation. Our great universities do not help young people to find out what is valuable and necessary. No one is interested in the ingredients of natural and simple happiness. Everyone wants gain and profit and thinks of happiness in terms of accumulations rather than in terms of internal maturity. So Buddha was pretty much right in assuming that we, somewhere in the remote time of things, headed civilization in the wrong direction. And no matter how much we have talked and fought, no matter how many great reformers and heroes have arisen among us, we have not been able to get progress back on the track. It is as though we had built a Grand Canyon of the Colorado, starting as a little dribble of water in the wrong direction, and now hopelessly locked within a canyon more than a mile deep. It's the same way with all these things that we do. We cannot accomplish peace because it interferes with our success or somebody else's success. We cannot reform without being subject to martyrdom. Everything is locked within a process that is going nowhere. And with nuclear fission at our doorstep, Buddha's statements have a new and tremendous validity. Namely, that the future of our own survival is in our own hands. Now, Buddhism has one factor which it took from Hinduism, which has had an important bearing on this, and that is the doctrine of reincarnation. Reincarnation is a combination of hope and hope and further fear. It is hope in the sense that it gives us more time to make the adjustments. But it also carries the factor of fear because it has the law of consequence locked in it. Namely, that as we have lived and as we have earned, so it will be paid. Therefore, we are all under a certain responsibility for the outcome of conduct. The immediate karmic reaction of most mistakes is right here in this world, where we see these mistakes bringing suffering. But there are long-range mistakes that do not solve themselves so easily. And the most important of these is our own human character. We can leave behind, for a while at least, some of the consequences of our unthoughtful conduct. But we must take the imperfection of our own natures with us and be prepared to come back and do it again, unless the enlightenment and change of realization occurs within ourselves. So Buddha sets out the pattern that each individual is capable of an adjustment that will last forever, an improvement which will add to the eternal growth of his own nature. Suffering does not produce growth directly. Suffering is growing the hard way. Suffering is the individual learning from his mistakes. But there is a direct way of growth in which the individual can learn from having done things well. And this form of growth is painless. The reward of right action is just as real and powerful as the penalty for wrong action. Each person has to work this out in his own nature. So in every way, Buddha ties up the difficulties of our time. Indigestion has something to do with international relationships. The probability that the person is going to have a coronary is due to conditions in which society, being benighted, impels him to follow a wrong example. There seems to be nothing short of a universal reformation that can change this. But Buddha also realized that the talk of universal reformation is a difficult conversation. It has too much in it. Therefore, the person, having only control of himself, must work first upon himself and try to liberate himself from that which is abnormal and unnatural. He also makes a very interesting observation, in directly or indirectly through his arhats, namely that actually so few people are interested really in growth that there is not much competition in that field. No one is going to blame us if we take away from them nothing that they value. And yet, in growing, we all grow and add up a great treasure of growth without anyone else in the world being poorer. Growth is the one great asset that is non-competitive. It is something that we can become wiser and wiser, but no one else will be injured unless we pervert that wisdom. So there is really no one who is going to really stand in our way and hate us simply because we try to be better. Of course, we have to be a little careful about it because we mustn't tell them our intention. If we go around telling people that we're trying to be better, we will either be ridiculed or persecuted. But if in our conduct we are better, they will all benefit from it also. So there is very little danger to those who live well, but there is great danger to those who talk about living well. If we do it ourselves, there is a very good way of meeting the problem. So we then come to the last and most important step in Buddha's doctrine, the noble truth of the path that leads to the end of suffering. This is the reason for the rise of the Sangha, as it was called in Buddhism, or the fellowship, the assembly of the devout. This was a group of persons who were determined in themselves to live well. Buddhism has never produced any form of religious hierarchy that is comparable to other religions. It does not tell the individual that he must obey certain other persons, or that there is a vast structure that he must not vary from. The Buddhist Sangha is an assembly of persons who are determined in their own lives and in their daily actions to educate themselves in value, that they will really do the things that are necessary to bring security to themselves and improve the general state of human existence. Now, the noble truth of the path that leads to the end of suffering is the gradual transformation, reclamation, and adjustment of the mental emotional complex within the individual. Unless we rectify the individual in his own life, we cannot bring an end to suffering. No one can make another person good, but each person can become good in his own right if he so desires. He can gradually weed out those dangerous attitudes and habits which contribute to suffering. He can do all kinds of small things every day to rescue his point of awareness from the wrong objectives. he can begin to think in terms of the Socratic moderation, for example. He will learn gradually that moderation in living in this world minimizes suffering, that immoderation maximizes it. The individual who lives the simple life makes fewer mistakes. The person who complicates his life with ulterior motives makes many mistakes. Therefore, in the Buddhist philosophy, simplicity is the key to the good life. Simplicity is the individual who is not as much concerned over what he has as he is over what he is as a human being. If value comes first, the value is in himself. There is not enough wealth in all the world to prevent misery. No individual can have so much of anything that he is free from danger and free from suffering. Today, if he has very much, he is going to be subject to mugging and burglarizing. The whole world is trying to tell him something, trying to tell him that his objectives are wrong and that these objectives are contributing to the creation of crime in society. So Buddha talked about the simple way, the Noble Eightfold Path, which leads to the perfection of all things in the law of life. This path is moderation in all appetites and the gradual simplifying of ambitions and their transformation into aspirations, the individual dreaming about being more in terms of value rather than having more. The most that the individual can ever possess in this world is himself. All other things are intangible. And he can only take with him what he is. What he has remains for others to waste. The more simple his life, the more likely he is to move quietly along the path of years, and will free his mind and his heart for those labors which are profitable in terms of growth. All the success in the world is not as important to health as the ability to make a friend and be a friend.